Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Daniel Sowa, a former mediator in the Bosnian War who participated in the Dayton peace talks and discussed comparisons between the previous use of American military force based on humanitarian grounds and the current threat to bomb Syria because of the regime's use of chemical weapons against its own people. Then we'll get an analysis of who the Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad is and how his so-called reforms that deviated from Ba'athist socialism towards neoliberal crony capitalism led to the rebellion that has now metastasized into a brutal civil war. An Iranian-Syrian scholar and political analyst whose uncle was close to the regime, Dr. Majid Rafizadeh, joins us to discuss how the Western-educated ophthalmologist who threatens to ignite the region unless he rules over Syria continues to argue it is either him or the terrorists. Then we look into the uphill battle the president has to get the House to approve his war resolution, which an overwhelming majority of Americans oppose. MJ Rosenberg, a special correspondent for the Washington Spectator, who worked as a senior House and Senate staffer for 15 years, joins us to discuss the role that AIPAC, the so-called Israel lobby, is playing in rounding up votes for Obama. Then finally, longtime staff writer for The New Yorker and a regular contributor to The New York Review of Books, Mark Danner, joins us to discuss recent U.S. interventions and how lessons could be applied to the Syrian situation as we await the U.N. report on the August 21st chemical weapons attack expected at the end of next week, and while a group of Nobel laureates, the elders, call for a referral to the International Criminal Court. And joining us now is Daniel Sowa, who served as the U.S. Special Envoy and Coordinator for the Bosnian Federation, mediating between Croats and Muslims from 1994 to 1996, and he participated in negotiating the first agreement reached at the Dayton peace talks. He also was the Vice President for Centers of Peace Building Innovation at the United States Institute for Peace and is now a professor at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. He also blogs at peacefair.net. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daniel Sowa.
Pleasure to be with you.
And do you see analogies between what happened in Bosnia in terms of a very reluctant president, both his predecessor George H.W. Bush and President Clinton, very reluctant to get involved in the Balkan wars, but eventually did? And do you see an analogy with the current president, who does not seem in any way to be like his predecessor George W. Bush, seems to be much more cautious and seems to be reluctant to get involved, but is now prepared to act on the red line that he's drawn over the use of chemical weapons?
There are some obvious analogies, but I want to emphasize that, you know, the world has changed since the 1990s. The Russia of that period is not the Russia of today. The Syria is not Bosnia. And the Arab world isn't the Arab world, and the United States is different, too. So there may be some analogies, but the context is quite different, I would say, especially after the Iraq and Afghanistan wars.
But the extent to which the Dayton peace accords happened, apparently, because of the bombing, in other words, you had to bomb Milosevic to get him to the peace tables, does that hold in this analogy with Syria?
Well, we don't know whether it holds or not, but what we know is that bombing itself is not a solution, and that bombing, if it's undertaken, should be undertaken within the context of a broader political strategy. What President Obama is saying is he wants a quick, sharp military intervention with no follow-up. And I just don't think that that's a formula that works, and I don't think it's a formula that can be held to either.
Well, isn't the problem here the dictator himself and the dictatorship? I mean, this is somebody...
There's no question in my mind, but that is the problem. It's Bashar al-Assad's refusal to leave power that is at the root of the problem, and a quick, sharp bombing isn't going to affect that at all. And the president is saying he understands that, but he will stop at that. I'm not so convinced that we can stop at that. What if Bashar al-Assad escalates the chemical attacks or conventional attacks, for that matter? What if something we do causes the collapse of the regime and there's a chaotic situation in Syria that threatens law and order in the neighbors as well, even the state structure of the neighbors, Lebanon, Jordan, Iraq, Turkey? The consequences of military intervention are extremely difficult to predict, and you have to be prepared not only to intervene but to follow up that intervention depending on what happens as a consequence.
Well, is this to say then that regime decapitation, it would be the only strategy? Because one of the lessons from Iraq is clear that the neoconservatives that brought us that disaster, one of the most boneheaded things they did was to demobilize the Iraqi army. And that meant instead of having 400,000 soldiers who could have kept the peace, stopped the looting and maintained order, you had 400,000 unemployed, armed and angry men who became the insurgency. So if you were able to get rid of the Assads, the dictatorship, the family, this mafia family that's ruled this place for over 40 years, would you be able to keep the military and not repeat the mistake of Iraq?
I think that was possible a year ago. I'm less convinced now. I'm less convinced because the Syrian opposition, which at one time was saying that they wanted to preserve the army and the state structures, is now so resentful of what has happened that they're much more inclined to destroy it. I'm afraid that we face in the whatever happens, that we will eventually face a state collapse in Syria that may be very chaotic and very threatening to the region. And that could happen even if we don't intervene. Not intervening doesn't save you from the consequences of the Syrian war.
Again, I'm speaking with Daniel Serwer, who mediated between Croats and Muslims as a U.S. Special Envoy to the Bosnian Federation in 1994 to 1996, and he participated in negotiating the first agreements reached at the Dayton Peace Accords, and he also was the Vice President for Centers of Peacebuilding Innovation at the United States Institute for Peace, and is now a professor at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. He also blogs at peacefair.net. I find what is extraordinary here, Daniel Serwer, is the role of Saudi Arabia and, to a lesser extent, Qatar in bringing in the jihadis, which, of course, serves the ends of the Assad dictatorship. One of the ways that they are able to justify their dictatorial rule to the Syrian people and the minorities who feel that they're being protected by this regime, like the Christians, is essentially that, you know, without me, you'd have Islamic terrorists and Al-Qaeda running the country. And it obviously resonates, and it's not entirely untrue. Why do we allow the Saudis to continually stab us in the back? They created the Taliban. They created Al-Qaeda. They've radicalized Pakistan. And now they've put in these al-Nusra people who really... And my understanding is that the Assad military doesn't really go after al-Nusra. They beat up in the Free Syrian Army because they want these guys in there as a way to justify their dictatorship.
I don't see al-Nusra as a direct product of Saudi policy. I see al-Nusra as fed by a jihadi movement that is strong many places, including in Saudi Arabia, and fed very largely, so far as I can tell, by private money rather than public money. You know, I think we probably talk to the Saudis more about the jihadis and terrorists than about anything else these days. I think they have a very difficult time as a state getting hold of this thing and preventing it from metastasizing. In Iraq, we faced a really dramatic rebellion on the part of Sunni terrorists, and they have united now also with Syrian Sunni terrorists in Syria, and we're facing a regional problem.
And that, of course, is the problem that Vladimir Putin continually points out to Barack Obama, which apparently he did fairly successfully at the G20 meeting in St. Petersburg, where most of the participants sided with Russia, or at least ended up on the side of non-intervention as opposed to joining President Obama and the French.
Well, the problem you've got is that what Putin is doing, which is supporting Bashar al-Assad, is making the problem worse and not better. And I have every reason to believe that the Sunni extremists will eventually make life very unpleasant also for Moscow. I find Putin's position on this question absolutely incomprehensible, since Bashar al-Assad and his excessive reaction to what had been a nonviolent, peaceful rebellion has created a situation that is much worse for Russia than had existed previously.
So what is the rationale then? You understand, is it just that he's, you know, the president referred to him recently as a scowling schoolboy in the corner. Is this personal as opposed to geostrategic?
No, I think it's just strategic in the sense that Moscow is trying to defy the United States, and by defying the United States, enhance its world status, try to regain superpower status. It's a pretty bad way of doing that, but it works very well for Putin in domestic politics, where he's quite popular because of the nationalist anti-American stance that he takes.
Well, you know, there's a similar stance here in the United States, in the heartland of this country. The Congress people back in their districts are getting yelled at by their constituents. The American people are not aboard intervention. It's pretty clear.
No, it's very clear that the American people are not keen on military intervention at this point. If the president wins in Congress, it'll be because he's won over the Congress, not because he's won over the whole country. He's going to have a very difficult uphill fight winning even in the Congress, especially on the House side.
Well, this is his extraordinary high wire act, isn't it? If he gets voted down, it would be a humiliation and he'd become a lame duck very quickly. And if he squeaks by and gets the vote, he's going to have to perform some kind of miracle here. And we've discussed the only possible outcome. I mean, in fact, you're suggesting there's no good outcome. I was suggesting that maybe with regime decapitation, as they politely refer to it. You know, I keep talking to the Free Syrian Army people, and they keep saying, all you have to do is get rid of the Assads, this mafia family, and Syria will heal itself. I think that's a bit of a pipe dream, but...
I think that's a bit of a pipe dream as well. I'm not saying that there's no good solution. I'm saying that there are a lot of risks in doing something or in not doing anything. There are risks on both sides. I think the right way to point is towards a diplomatic solution, which at the moment we can't get without military intervention. And that diplomatic solution, which has been laid out in an agreement reached more than a year ago with the Russians, would decapitate in the sense of take all power away from Bashar al-Assad and give it to a government formed with the approval of both the opposition and the regime in Damascus. That kind of power-sharing arrangement is very difficult to manage, but it seems to me the right way to go if we want to avoid either a jihadi success in Syria or a success for the regime.
Well, that would involve the need to bring the Iranians into the mix, wouldn't it? I don't see how you could make
that. It absolutely requires bringing the Iranians into the mix, and I don't see much purpose served at this point by trying to keep them out. The Iranians are making loud noises against the use of chemical weapons. Of course, they're blaming the use on the opposition, but they know full well that that's not true. So I think there is some potential for the Iranians getting fed up with Bashar al-Assad.
Well, Daniel Sova, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Daniel Sowa, who served as U.S. Special Envoy and Coordinator for the Bosnian Federation, mediating between Croats and Muslims from 1994 to 1996, and he participated in negotiating the first agreement reached at the Dayton Peace Accords. He also was the Vice President for Centers of Peace Building Innovation at the United States Institute for Peace and is now a professor at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and he also blogs at peacefair.net. And we're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with an analysis of who the Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad is.